Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, it's Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. It's Tuesday, June 28th. I want to read you something from the data site 538. You know 538? They crunch numbers on things like poll numbers. They aggregate polls and describe what the poll numbers taken together might mean. There's a lot of sports data on 538. They look closely at elections. Some of you know this site, Nate Silver's site. 538 is a reference to the number of electoral votes in a presidential election, and they look closely state by state. It's a data crunching site. So this is the last place that I expected to find some analysis related to the growing illegality of abortion in America. But I'm just going to read from 538, and you'll get why this appears on a data site. It says, giving birth in the U.S. is already far more dangerous than in other wealthy countries. Ending the protections of Roe versus Wade, the 1973 decision that established the constitutional right to abortion, could make it even more so. Multiple studies have found that the states that already have the tightest restrictions on abortion also have the highest rates of maternal and infant mortality. And that correlation stubbornly persists after researchers account for some of the other differences between states, like racial demographics and healthcare policy. Some researchers think that abortion restrictions are part of the reason why pregnancy and childbirth are so much more dangerous in the U.S. Then it continues, there are ways abortion restrictions could kill people, both directly and indirectly. And scientists say these correlations point toward dangerous disparities in healthcare access in the U.S., not just in terms of who can get an abortion, but also in terms of who can get preventative care while pregnant or even before. And it continues, the U.S. is a uniquely dangerous place to have a child. So that struck me as another thing that's important to talk about with respect to the restriction of abortion rights in the U.S., that it contributes, and there are stats to back it up and studies to back it up, maternal mortality in the United States, and that's especially disproportionately true among African Americans. Back with us now is Nancy Northup, president and CEO of the Center for Reproductive Rights, the lead litigator in the Mississippi abortion rights case that has now wound up in the complete reversal of Roe versus Wade. Where does the Center for Reproductive Rights go from here? Legally, the end of Roe is not the end of the story. Politically, it is certainly not the end of the story. And individually, where does anyone with an unwanted pregnancy go from here? Nancy, welcome back to WNYC. You came on when the case was argued, and thank you for coming back on, even though the case was lost. Hello.
Thank you, and good morning.
And I guess the first thing to say is your worst fears were realized in this decision. Did you expect it all along?
You know, it was troubling when the Supreme Court took the case in May of 2021 because it had been struck down by both the trial and appellate court below. So there was no reason to take the case. It had been settled law for 50 years that a pre-viability ban on abortion was unconstitutional. So it was troubling when they took the case. But we felt that, you know, there was such massive support from so many sectors for following the rule of law and for the health and justice and equality reasons to support Roe versus Wade. I mean, amicus briefs were filed by leading economists, by the American Medical Association, other medical associations, public health associations, you know, all across, athletes, you know, Olympic athletes from all sectors of life saying that this is a really core individual personal liberty. So, but, you know, troubling questions at oral argument, the draft leaked opinion, but nonetheless, it was still stunning to read it last Friday in black and white and just to witness this extraordinary act of judicial activism. I mean, it was just, it's the first time that the Supreme Court has stripped away a personal liberty right. And consequently, we're already seeing the harms and they're coming fast and furious.
I think of it, the emotional reaction that people are having to this, as kind of like when somebody dies after they've been really, really sick and in decline, and everybody knows they're going to die, and then at a certain point, everybody knows they're going to die any day. But then when it happens, you're still in shock. And it was kind of like this since the Alito draft. Everybody kind of knew this was going to happen. Maybe not 100% to what degree, but it seemed like this was happening. And that went on for weeks and weeks and weeks. And here it came, and it happened, and everybody's still in shock, even though we were expecting it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a sound analogy, with the exception is that there's no peace, right? What we're thrown into now is just absolute chaos, as we are seeing states across the nation do what we expected them to do, which is, you know, waste no time in moving to enforce their trigger bans, which were designed to spring into effect if Roe was overturned, trying to revive pre-Roe bans, trying to lift injunctions on other unconstitutional six-week bans and others. So it's, you know, there's no time to grieve because we are back at it. Center for Reproductive Rights filed a slew of lawsuits yesterday, and we did get an injunction in Louisiana. So the attempt to ban abortion at the moment is stayed in Louisiana. Planned Parenthood got an injunction in Utah. But there are many states right now where abortion is unavailable, and it's just a travesty.
Let's talk about Louisiana, because at least we can say that this case of yours is an actual victory of sorts, just in these few days after Roe was overturned, having to do with Louisiana's trigger law that was going to take effect. So what exactly happened there?
Yes, well, Louisiana actually passed three different trigger laws. And so that is part of the chaos and confusion. And abortions had stopped, but we went to court to file for an injunction, and that was granted yesterday. This is in state court. And one thing everybody should be aware of is that they remember from high school civics, if they're not an attorney, that, of course, we have both federal protections in our federal constitution, but also every state has a constitution. So you can, and we have state laws as well as federal laws. So this is filed in state court in Louisiana, challenging all three of their trigger bans on vagueness and that it's impossible to tell which is in effect and thus what exceptions exist. And so right now it is stayed, and our client in Shreveport, Louisiana, Hope Medical Group has said that they will be resuming procedures as long as the injunction is in place.
Uh-huh. And what's the potential ultimate outcome of that case that you would hope for? I mean, it sounds like they're going to have to clarify these competing vague trigger laws, and it's not going to be great for abortion rights in any case. Or is there a better and a worse scenario?
Well, in Louisiana, it's tough because Louisiana does not protect the substantive, the actual right to abortion in their constitution. That's already been determined that there's not that right in their constitution. Other states do have abortion protected in their constitution, including places like Kansas and Montana and Florida, where you might not realize that. So really, right now, our immediate priority is maintaining access in Louisiana and also in every state for as long as possible. And that's because, I mean, you know, every week, every day that people can access the care they need and make the decisions that are best for themselves and their families, it changes their life. And so we are right now highest priority focusing on keeping the clinics open for as long as we can.
What could President Biden do by executive action? Anything specific that you have in mind?
Well, there are a number of things, but I want to focus on one that I think is could have a really, really important impact. So in his Friday comments, you know, following the decision, President Biden spoke to the fact that he would do everything in his power to protect a woman's right in states. And he specifically emphasized the importance of access to medications like mifepristone, which has been approved by the Food and Drug Administration for over 20 years, as safe and effective. And, you know, here's what should happen. We are facing a public health emergency. And you went over some of that data at the beginning of the hour, talking about, you know, there's well-documented adverse health consequences of restricting access to abortion, complications and maternal death associated with pregnancy, childbirth, unsafe abortion methods. And the Secretary of Health and Human Services should be declaring a public health emergency. And then to mitigate the harms that are well-known, well-documented, the Secretary should supersede state abortion bans as applied to medication abortion. And this would be under the Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act. It's called the PREP Act. And that would allow medication abortion, safe and effective up to 10 weeks, can be done by telemedicine under the FDA's rulings. So somebody can do a telehealth visit and get it by mail. And this should reach even in those states that will ban abortion outright. So that is a very important step that the Secretary of Health and Human Services could take. And that would, it would not cure all of the harms of the Supreme Court's decision, but it would mitigate, because women would be able to get medication abortion up to 10 weeks by telemedicine and mail in their homes.
You know, getting back to the decision itself for a minute, I think something that hasn't gotten enough attention is that the Supreme Court overturned the precedent of Roe versus Wade from 1973, but also of the Casey decision from 1992, almost 20 years later, that reaffirmed the essence of Roe after all those Reagan and George H.W. Bush justices had been appointed, and still that court reaffirmed the basis of Roe. So that's the extent to which the current justices, the majority, are marching to their own drummer, right?
That is completely correct. I mean, we're talking about almost 50 years of decisions by numerous justices on the Supreme Court, and including, as you just pointed out, Brian, the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision 30 years ago, in which, again, it was reaffirmed, including by Republican-appointed judges. So all of a sudden, and the dissent made it really clear that the change in personnel is the only thing that can be driving this result. And that is just stunning, to have three new justices on the court, and all of a sudden, all of the work, all of the thinking, right, all of the building of precedent upon precedent from all the prior justices just thrown in the trash can.
Mary in Princeton Junction, you're on WNYC with Nancy Northup, President and CEO of the Center for Reproductive Rights. Hi, Mary.
Oh, thank you very much. I didn't have to wait very long. I'm surprised. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm just wondering, I heard this rationale presented many, many years ago on some talk show. I couldn't begin to remember the circumstance or who the speaker was. But they offered an interesting legal challenge to these anti-abortion laws. There is nothing that I know of or that this person had ever heard of that requires anyone, man or woman, to go through any type of medical procedure or process that requires them to do that in order to save the life of someone else. No one can be forced to donate blood. No one can be forced to go through bone marrow transplant or donate a kidney for someone who is dying but is already here in the world. Why does a woman have to be required to go through the process of pregnancy and childbirth, which have huge statistical, you know, outcomes that are terrible? I don't understand why, you know, we can't just have a Congress pass a law that doesn't say we're going to protect abortion. We're going to protect people from being required to go through a medical process to save anybody else.
Yeah.
It should be voluntary.
Interesting. Now, you'd still need 60 votes or abolishing the filibuster in the Senate to do that. But Mary, thank you very much. Please call us again. And that's an interesting legal framework. Nancy, is it one that you've thought about before?
Well, yes, I think that what the caller is talking about is the right to bodily autonomy. So we have, you know, dominion over our own bodies, and it's recognized in the constitutional law. And so that's part of the, you know, constellation of rights that are under this personal liberty right. So it's a very good point that she's making about bodily autonomy. And, You know, unfortunately, the Supreme Court gave no weight to it.
Spencer in Berkeley Heights has another thought of a way to go. Spencer, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. You had mentioned earlier with your guest that if you look at states that have access to abortion versus states that don't have access to abortion, there is a clear disparity in terms of mortality for women giving birth. If you take that factoid and put it off to the side and then just compare pregnancy mortality between whites and blacks, you see a huge disparity between those ethnic groups. So by extension, the removal of access to abortion means that the rate for blacks should continue to go up. Could one not make the argument then that depriving the right to abortion is, call it tacit racism, because you're now basically turning an entire ethnic group into being that much more likely to die as a result?
Right. Disparate impact.
I think they call it disparate impact
under the law. Nancy, as the lawyer in the room, is there a potential case there on those grounds?
Well, I think we have some very good, you know, legal thinkers in the calls, whether they're lawyers or not. I mean, yes, the black women are roughly 2 to 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy complications than, you know, white women. And as the Center for Disease Control has assessed, that 2 out of 3 of these are preventable. So, yes, I mean, I think what Spencer's identifying here is that this is an issue of racial justice, because when you know, and these are known by the government, right? This is the Center for Disease Control. When you know there's going to be a particular impact and you turn a blind eye to it, that is acting in a way that you know is going to cause, you know, racial injustice and racial discrimination. So I think one of the things that was very clear when this case was litigated in the Supreme Court is, of course, it's an issue of gender equality, but it's also an issue of racial justice, and it's an issue of economic justice. I mean, half of women who have abortions in the United States are living in poverty. And so all of these issues come together. And Brian, I do want to make sure, can I mention one thing? Because it was just released by the New York Attorney General today. Uh-huh. For your listeners. But the Attorney General and 24 national law firms and leading reproductive rights organizations, including the Center for Reproductive Rights, are part of her new pro bono task force on reproductive health. And one of the things she launched today is a hotline, which is going to be free and is available in 12 of the most common languages here in New York, for callers to find out what they need to know in this fast, you know, changing environment. So it's to provide legal guidance and resources to patients and healthcare providers in New York, but also for people out of New York who want to come into New York. So if you go to the Attorney General's website, there'll be information about that. But in all of this confusion, it's going to be helpful, because New York also just passed some new laws last week in terms of, maybe in the week before, in terms of protection of reproductive health care. So just wanted to flag for you the Attorney General's hotline on legal information about abortion.
I'm glad you mentioned it, because as you say, that's brand new this morning and I hadn't even seen it yet. So good for people to know. Well, related to that, do some of the state laws that prohibit abortion services provided out of state to a resident, like a resident of Texas who comes to New York or New Jersey and has an abortion that's perfectly legal here, does Texas actually say it can prosecute that provider in New York and ask the state of New York or the state of New Jersey to extradite that person?
So, you know, right now that is not, the black letter of the law in Texas. You know, the concerns that people have, and one of the things that is, you know, quite disheartening right now is that abortion funds in the state of Texas have at the moment stopped helping patients with funding to get out of state, because they're concerned about some language in a pre-Roe ban that might be get them caught up in aiding and abetting. So, you know, first of all, people in a state ought to be able to share information about where you can go to have an abortion out of the state. And you should absolutely, That's another thing that the president flagged, was that the federal government was going to be very vigilant in making sure that people's fundamental right to go to another state to get services that are legal in that state cannot be interfered with. But there are lawmakers, you know, who have, you know, threatened to try to do just that, to basically try to imprison people within their own states and not let people help them and not let them go to other states, or try to come after providers in a state like New York. And New York has passed legislation to shield them from that. So we're going to see so much, you know, the states are now involved against one another in this battle for ensuring access to reproductive health care.
A related question from a listener via Twitter. How does the Roe ruling affect patient-doctor confidentiality?
Really great questions from your listeners. And again, this is, I think, one that one could call the Attorney General's hotline. You know, we have doctor-patient confidentiality, and there's real concern when abortion is criminalized that you can go after phone records, and, you know, there's concern about, you know, people who use, you know, apps for you know, tracking their cycles. And wanting data security, as well as obviously security of medical information in the possession of doctors. So all of these things, it is a terrible idea to criminalize a, you know, healthcare, because it is an invasion, not only interrupting one's getting healthcare, but all of these privacy concerns come to the fore.
Well, it is not over, folks. I think that's the takeaway from this conversation with Nancy Northup, president and CEO of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which was the lead litigator in the Mississippi case. It's not over legally. It's not over politically. It's not over personally. So many battlegrounds yet to be fought on. Nancy, thank you for coming on with us again.
Well, thank you. And it's the Center for Reproductive Rights. And if your listeners, Constitutional Rights,
sorry,
another great organization.
Else.
Great organization. But also, if your listeners want to track what's happening, they can go to reproductiverights.org, What If Roe Fell, and they can see what's happening in the various states.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.